Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric Kingston of the Strengthen Social Security Campaign, who explains why he believes the failure of the Congressional Deficit Supercommittee may be the best option for citizens fighting to protect federal social safety net programs. Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network, who assesses a federal state task force proposal to restore the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of last year's devastating British petroleum oil spill. And journalist Arun Gupta, who talks about the reasons why he believes the Occupy Wall Street protests have expanded so rapidly and the effect of police tactics being used to suppress this new anti-corporate movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over the last decade, harsh counterterrorism measures have hindered the delivery of humanitarian aid to crisis hotspots such as Somalia and Gaza, according to a new report from the London-based Overseas Development Institute. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks in the United States, the United Nations Security Council and major aid donors, including the U.S. and Britain, required aid agencies to screen employees and local partners for links to declared terrorist groups. Concern over indirectly aiding al-Shabaab in Somalia and Hamas in Gaza has reduced aid to the people in these conflict zones. Anti-terrorist laws such as the Patriot Act put new pressure on Islamic charities, especially after the conviction of officials with the Holy Land Foundation for providing material support to Hamas. International assistance was cut off to Hamas after the Islamic political movement won Palestinian parliamentary elections in 2006. Current sanctions on Somalia dating back to 1992 ban aid groups from giving material support to the al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab movement that controls most of south-central Somalia. Aid groups have also been hindered from assisting famine victims by al-Shabaab's hostility to Western-funded humanitarian groups. In Gaza, tensions grew when Hamas demanded an audit of the U.S.-funded International Medical Corps. The aid group balked at the audit, and Hamas responded by closing the group's Gaza office. Medical Corps was able to resume their operations in Gaza only after international mediation convinced Hamas to delay the audits. Hundreds of women in Yemen set fire to their veils in a dramatic protest against the government crackdown on the nation's opposition movement after 25 activists were killed in clashes with police. Women have played a significant role in the civil uprising against the authoritarian rule of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. In October, Yemeni women's rights activist Tawakkul Kaman won the Nobel Peace Prize with two women from Liberia, including the president, for their work linking peace and women's rights. In the capital city of Sana'a, women discarded their full-body veils, known as makrama, put them in a pile, and set them ablaze. As the veils burned, the women chanted, "Who protects Yemeni women from the crimes of the thugs?" President Saleh returned from Saudi Arabia in late September after recovering from injuries suffered in a June bombing of his compound. Saleh has resisted international calls to step down and has not accepted a power-sharing deal. He recently told the U.S. ambassador in Yemen he would only step down if he was granted immunity from prosecution. Meanwhile, thousands of opposition protesters continued to fill the streets of Yemeni cities as the government's counterterrorism chief was killed in a car bombing in the country's southern city of Aden. Debt owed on student loans in the U.S. has surged past $1 trillion, placing another drag on a stagnant economy. College students are now borrowing for college at twice the rate they did in the late 1990s, resulting in a doubling of the student loan debt in the last 5 years. Since 2000, college enrollment has risen 38%, while little new financial aid was available to help students pay for increased tuition costs. According to Alternet, 11% of all student loan payments are 90 days late, rivaling late payments on credit cards. The squeeze on college graduates will only get worse as 20-somethings face record unemployment and a crowded job market. Students with the highest default rate on college loans were those who attended for-profit institutions, such as the University of Phoenix, which gets 90% of its revenues from the federal government. Unlike stressed homeowners, there is little young people can do to escape loan collectors on student debt. In the wake of persistently high unemployment, there are new calls for student loan forgiveness. An online petition, which received over 300,000 signatures, supports student loan forgiveness as a measure that could trigger economic stimulus. A write-off of student loan debt could aid 35 million young adults by freeing up $400 to $1,000 a month in funds that could be spent on goods and services, helping to boost the stagnant economy. Acknowledging the problem, President Obama recently issued an executive order that will reduce monthly student loan payments from 15 to 10% of their discretionary income. Beginning next year, the order will also allow qualified students to consolidate their loans. Those loans will be forgiven if not paid off in 20 years instead of the current 25 years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
As a result of a deal reached in negotiations to break the impasse over raising the nation's debt ceiling in August, the so-called Congressional Supercommittee was formed, composed of 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans, half from the House and half from the Senate. The committee is charged with making cuts or increasing revenue to reduce the nation's deficit by at least $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. The panel must reach a bipartisan agreement, then pass the recommendation on to Congress by November 23rd. If the panel cannot reach a deal, that failure would trigger automatic cuts in domestic and defense spending in the 2013 federal budget. Press reports on leaks from the secretive deliberations of the supercommittee say the panel's Democrats proposed a grand bargain of spending cuts and new taxes worth up to $3 trillion. The recommendation reportedly included $400 billion in cuts from Medicare, $80 billion in cuts to Medicaid, and increased taxes on high income brackets while eliminating some deductions for upper-income earners. Social Security is also on the chopping block, with a proposal to significantly reduce benefits through a switch to what's called the Chained Consumer Price Index. With Occupy Wall Street movement protest against corporate greed gaining support around the country, and a new Congressional Budget Office report highlighting data on rising income inequality over the last 30 years, the Democrats' proposal has provoked widespread opposition. Your reporter spoke with Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, a coalition of 300 national and state organizations. He explains why he believes the failure of the supercommittee may be the best option for citizens fighting to protect federal social safety net programs.
The newspapers reported that a majority of the Democrats on the committee were open to considering cutting the cost of living adjustment into the future and making major cuts in Medicare. And they were committed to that on the basis that they might get some revenues from the Republicans. Of course, the Republicans came back and said, oh, we're sort of all for those cuts and we'd like them to be bigger, but, you know, you're asking for too much in revenues, and they're really asking for very little. The proposal the Democrats put forward, hopefully it's just a trial balloon and they'll back off of it, especially if all of your listeners send notices and calls to their senators and to the representatives. The proposal is just plain outrageous. It's more conservative than what the president proposed to Mr. Boehner earlier in the summer and that the speaker rejected. The major problem, putting aside conservative, liberal, the proposal that's being put forth and that's being discussed by the supercommittee in terms of Social Security, one of the major concerns is if they change the way they calculate the cost of living adjustment, it means that every single beneficiary will be getting a little bit less every year into the future. And that adds up so that after 10 years of receiving Social Security benefits, it would be the equivalent of about a $700 cut in year 10, say when you're 75. After 20 years, it would be the equivalent in year 20 at age 85 of about a $1,000 cut. And if you live to age 95, which some of our people are fortunate enough to do, it would be a cut in your 95th year of $1,400 in comparable money today. So it's taking a very modest benefit, which is an average of $14,000 for retirees or so, and saying, we're going to let inflation eat away a little bit. They say they have a better inflation measure, but they really don't. It's just a technical game to reach into the pockets of Social Security beneficiaries and pull the equivalent of $112 billion out of those pockets over 10 years.
Eric, what happens if this super committee cannot reach an agreement? There are some automatic cuts that take place both in the domestic and defense spending budgets. What would be better from where you sit in terms of these deep cuts to the entitlement programs, the Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, or how deep and awful will the automatic cuts be?
You say nothing good is going to come out of the super committee and out of this deficit ceiling decision. We shouldn't be having this discussion. As I said, we ought to be looking at putting Americans back to work and how to make prudent decisions short-term to spend more to boost the economy and boost demand, and then look out into the long-term at how to deal with projected deficits. And much of the problem of the long-term has to do with rising health care costs, which we have to get control of as a nation. So nothing good is going to come out of it. Probably the best thing from my point of view that can come out of the super committee is deadlock. And the reason for that is, if that happens, there will be automatic sequesters, automatic pulling back of $1.2 trillion. Half will come out of defense, half will come out of domestic spending, but they protect Social Security, they protect programs for low-income people like Medicaid, SSI. They partially protect Medicare. They say Medicare can be cut by up to 2%, but it can only be cuts that affect the providers. So if nothing happens, that's what happens, and it doesn't go into effect until 2013, even possibly later. So we can have a presidential election and congressional elections that debate whether we ought to be talking about letting the Bush tax cuts expire, whether we ought to be talking about, as some have proposed, placing higher taxes on those Americans who've done most well in the past few years, and really asking those who crashed the economy to make a very serious contribution to rebuilding the economy.
That was Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign. Learn more about the coalition's work to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After last year's British Petroleum oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, a federal state task force began looking at ways to address long-term environmental damage along the Gulf Coast. The Gulf Coast Ecosystem Restoration Task Force issued a preliminary strategy in early October that has been hailed by many stakeholders as a step in the right direction. The oil disaster panel specified several goals, which include building resilient communities, protecting marine and coastal ecosystems, and safeguarding water quality. For many years, the bayous of coastal Louisiana have been losing a football field-sized piece of land every hour, land that reverts to open water. The task force includes many players like the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who often find themselves on opposite sides of proposed solutions. Founded in 1995, the Gulf Restoration Network is committed to uniting and empowering people to be responsible stewards of the Gulf of Mexico, working to restore the region as a natural, economic, and recreational resource that is central to the culture and heritage of five states and several nations. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Aaron Viles, Deputy Director of the Gulf Restoration Network, who talks about the task force proposals and where the money might come from to implement those plans.
The idea that the Corps of Engineers was in the room with the EPA and NOAA, kind of all agreeing that this is what needed to be done, really is relatively landmark. You know, getting those agencies to all agree that, you know what, we've managed the river for shipping and for flood control, and now it's time to put ecosystem restoration on kind of co-equal ground. That is a really important acknowledgement, and we're very hopeful that this agency will be able to see the course and ensure that that is actually implemented.
Does it always take a disaster to bring people and agencies together?
Clearly, a catastrophe and a major crisis can bring people together. You can have an aha moment where you understand that the ecosystem is threatened and that there are significant challenges ahead. And I think with the BP disaster, we certainly saw that kind of coming together. We shouldn't overstate the impact of the BP disaster because the administration actually was very engaged in these kind of coastal Mississippi, coastal Louisiana issues pre-BP. And they had actually developed a restoration roadmap that the White House Council on Environmental Quality had pulled together. We thought that was a really important working group. And then that kind of morphed into, in the wake of BP, this larger more powerful entity that came up with some more sweeping recommendations. So, you know, I think they had done their homework pre-BP to understand that, you know, on April 19th, 2010, the day before the Deepwater Horizon exploded and 11 men tragically lost their lives, this ecosystem was not in a good place. So they acknowledged that those challenges were there beforehand, and that what BP did is just make them kind of more immediate.
Do you know what's the dollar amount that BP is going to pay, and are they paying a set amount that politicians will decide how to use, or are they paying a certain amount specifically for restoration?
We know that BP has already committed $1 billion for early restoration before the full damage assessment is even completed. We expect perhaps another early restoration payment before the final settlement. But then, kind of independent of that natural resource damage assessment process, there are these Clean Water Act fines. So because BP has spilled a historic amount of oil into the Gulf of Mexico, they will be hit with a historic Clean Water Act fine. And that depends. It could be anywhere from $5 billion to upwards of $20 billion, depending on a few different factors. And that is where kind of politics comes into play, because the way the current law works, that money would go into an oil spill response trust fund and then go into just the general treasury after that trust fund is capped at, I think, $3 billion. So what is going on right now is there's a couple of different pieces of legislation, one in the Senate, one in the House, that would take 80% of those ultimate Clean Water Act fines from BP and bring them back to the Gulf to help restore this ecosystem that BP's oil clearly is affecting, but that needed help before BP, and putting in some of these long-needed restoration features and projects moving forward.
Aaron Viles, there are several reasons you're losing a football field of land every hour. One is natural subsidence. Another is the fact that the sediment brought down the Mississippi River now is dumped into deep water and not along the shoreline, which helps build up the land. And the third is that the oil and gas industry has created thousands of miles of canals all through the area. Can you give an update on the status of both onshore and offshore oil and gas drilling compared to what it was before the BP disaster?
What we do know is that, you know, the oil industry in the Gulf of Mexico is, you know, kind of ramping back up, and that they are not at pre-BP levels of activity, but they're closing in on that, and the permits are certainly being issued. So, you know, even though BP's oil is still in the Gulf, it's still in our marsh, it's still washing up, every monitoring flight we take, we still see it. They're actually looking to do more deep water drilling. So we're concerned that, you know, not enough lessons have been learned from this disaster, and that we haven't changed the regulations enough, and we haven't increased the response capacity enough. But what we do know is that, you know, existing, that historic oil industry footprint in Louisiana's marsh is significant. They are responsible for 40 to 60% of the coastal land loss that we're experiencing. This amazing amount, you know, of football field of wetlands every hour that disappears, turns to open water because of largely the oil industry and their networks of thousands of miles of canals that have been carved through the coast, and then the fact that we've hemmed up the Mississippi River and kind of locked it into its path, and we've disconnected it from its floodplain so it never is able to actually put the sediment and the fresh water into the marshes that it once built. So, you know, there's a couple of different forces at work here. We need to really mitigate those forces. But what we do know is, you know, the industry continues. It's very profitable in the Gulf of Mexico, even at a level that, you know, is curtailed somewhat from the pre-BP disaster. We need to make sure that as the nation benefits from those resources, those hydrocarbons that are coming from the Gulf, they're also willing to ensure that the commitment to restoration is made at the federal level as well. And that's where I think these BP Clean Water Act fines are really key. And we need people from across the country to understand that America's Gulf Coast needs their commitment and needs these resources.
That was Aaron Viles, Deputy Director with the Gulf Restoration Network. Learn more about the task force proposals and the Restoration Network's campaign to protect the Gulf of Mexico by visiting our website at btlonline.org. After 6 weeks of rapid expansion to cities and towns across the U.S., activists participating in the Occupy Wall Street movement witnessed some of the worst police violence on October 25th, when Oakland police reportedly used stun grenades, rubber bullets, and tear gas to disperse hundreds of mostly peaceful protesters exercising their right of free speech at an encampment near City Hall. In the midst of the Oakland clashes, former Marine and Iraq War veteran Scott Olson sustained a skull fracture when he was shot in the head by an unknown police projectile. In response to the aggressive police tactics, Occupy Oakland activists issued a call for a citywide general strike on November 2nd, where they invited all students to walk out of schools, the shutdown of the city's port, the fifth busiest shipping container port in the U.S., and a march in the downtown area outside banks, corporations, foreclosed homes, schools, and libraries. Some unions, including the Service Employees International Union, responded to the general strike call and are encouraging members to seek time off work to stand in support of the Occupy Oakland action. While the violence in Oakland captured headlines and sparked solidarity marches across the U.S. and the world, other police actions to evict Occupy activists occurred in many other cities, including Denver, Nashville, Atlanta, Chicago, and Cleveland. Your reporter spoke with journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper, and a co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal, a newspaper published by activists in the occupied encampment in Lower Manhattan's Zuccotti Park. Here, Gupta talks about the reasons why he believes the Occupy protests have expanded so rapidly, and the effect of police tactics to suppress the new movement decrying corporate greed, economic inequality, and political corruption.
It has become an Occupy movement because people feel shut out, that they have no voice, they have no say, they have no control. People I've talked to in this occupation tour, me and my partner Michelle Fawcett have been doing, we've been to 10 different cities, and you hear variations on a theme, that my voice doesn't matter, my hands are tied, I have no control over my life. So you find a lot of people who are suffering, you know, that they have medical problems and can't get health insurance, or they've lost their job, or they're homeless, and they're part of the Occupy movement. But it's also an expression of the lack of social and political space to have a democratic voice. And I think this is why it has grown so explosively. There's something like over, 300 active occupations across the country, and then there's maybe close to 2,000 places where there's kind of people who are actively doing something in terms of having meetups or having like a regular weekly event or something to that effect. And it's really tapped into a deep well of anger and resentment, but also a lot of hope and inspiration, and that's why it's grown so explosively.
Over the past week, we've seen increased police crackdowns on the Occupy encampments all over this country, in Denver, Tennessee, Chicago, and certainly worst of all in Oakland, where there was wide reporting of the police violence there to evict Occupy activists from a park in Oakland. We saw the injury of Iraq war veteran Scott Olson, who sustained a serious skull fracture as a result, and those activists there in Oakland are now calling for a general strike on November 2nd. Where do you think all the police protester conflict is leading to, and how much does it really distract from the message that the protesters are out there to work on in the first place?
One of the definitions of the state is it has a monopoly on violence. And so it's not surprising that you're going to see police departments reacting with various degrees of force. I think what's interesting is how they react differently. And in New York, certainly, it was the police violence that actually built the movement. September 24th, that Saturday, that's where you get the infamous viral video of a officer nicknamed Tony Baloney who goes up and pepper sprays those women in the face who are doing nothing but standing on the sidewalk. Then the following week you had the 700 arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge. And I was down Zuccotti nearly every day. And after the Monday afterwards, you saw just explosive growth in terms of how the movement was taking off and the media response. What's going on in Oakland, that backfired also in terms of that has isolated the mayor and the police force. And to my understanding, at least a few days ago, to people who I was talking to, is there is a small occupation back there. Denver and Nashville, Denver it appears to have been more successful. Same with Atlanta. Nashville, though, you actually have a judge who's issued orders stopping the police from arresting people because he's saying that the curfew order is illegal. Chicago and then Cleveland are very different cases as well. Cleveland, they have managed to pretty much shut down the occupation. They're allowed to have a tent there 24 hours, but only one tent. Chicago, the protesters cannot even take a space. And the city hasn't reacted violently. But at the same time, also, you know, let's realize we're talking about maybe less than 10 cities when you have probably over 300 occupations.
Where do you see this movement headed in the next couple of months, in these harsh winter months coming up? I'm sure there's a lot of strategizing going on. We also hear some talk about, you know, coordination nationally, maybe a convention of some type this July 4th, some kind of horizontal democratic process to come up with a list of specific demands and tactics in order to make those demands real across the country. What are you hearing?
Well, when I go around to cities, and cities I've been to include Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Toledo, Allentown, Youngstown, D.C., Baltimore, I ask people, so what about this convention? And to tell you the truth, only one person has heard of it. You know, the movement is going through certain growing pains that are very important. I think one of the biggest questions on the table, this is looking out a year, is the relation to the 2012 election, because you have a lot of liberal groups and unions who can be counted on to be kind of the ground troops for Obama, and the Democrats right now are very much supporting the Occupy movement. But what's going to happen come next summer? I've heard some people say, like, occupy the conventions. And, you know, I think that's a good idea for the Occupy movement, speaking as an observer, that it should be taken to the convention sites themselves, because, you know, it's a two-party system, though really there's only one party, the corporate capitalism, and people should be taking the protests right up to these two parties that are two wings of the same problem. How do you translate this into action? Is it policies? Is it institutions? Yes and no. You need to meet people's needs, right? Getting back to the original thing that, you know, people need health care. They need jobs. They need housing. They need education. But is it going to happen through the same norms, just through redistribution? Or do we need to fundamentally think about a restructuring of social relations, of economic relations, of what is work like, what is society like? I think that's more the answer, but that's much more difficult, and it has to be something that happens in the doing and the making over time, but it's not going to be easy by any stretch.
That was journalist Arun Gupta, a founding editor of New York City's independent newspaper. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.